Hello, this is the Pearson EdExcel International GCSE English as a Second Language, Paper 2 Listening Test, Summer 2016. This test is in three parts. You will hear three extracts and will have to answer questions on what you hear. At the beginning of each extract, there will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all three parts twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen. Part 1. In this part, you will hear a teacher talking about the school musical. Listen and complete the notes. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each completed answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Good afternoon, everyone. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Joe Major, Head of Drama, and I'd like to welcome you to this information session on the school musical. This year, we'll be performing A Tale of One City. This American musical was first performed in 1957 and has been popular worldwide ever since. It tells the story of two rival groups of teenagers living in the same New York neighborhood, and is loosely based on themes found in Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. It has a very large cast of performers, and we'll be looking for a wide range of talents. Now, these talents fall into three main groups. Firstly, there are the singers for the main parts and the chorus. There are also speaking-only parts, and there are parts for dancers. These are the people who will be on stage. The second group is made up of the musicians, so people who would like to be in the orchestra. But that's not all. The third group, which plays an incredibly important part in the success of any production, is the backstage crew. We need at least 40 people to help out here, and we're looking for people to build the scenery, make the costumes, and do the sound, as well as promote the production. Whilst I will be the director of this year's production, other members of the teaching staff will be responsible for specific areas of the musical. Mr. Johns will be working with students wishing to be on stage. Mrs. Sherborne will be looking after the music, and Miss Stewart will be in charge of everything behind the scenes. They will be here at the front of the room once this presentation is over. Please sign up with a relevant teacher if you would like to be involved in this production. So, here is a brief timeline for the musical. It will be performed over 3 days in March. The first performance will be on Thursday, the 15th of March. This will be an evening performance. We'll do it all again on Friday, but on Saturday, the 17th of March, we'll be putting on a matinee performance as well as one in the evening. This is a new departure for us, but we wanted you to experience what life is really like in the theatre. We'll be holding auditions next month, and rehearsals will start in November. We've also decided to hold a school musical weekend in late February, so that we can have an opportunity to relax and get to know one another more. We're planning to go to the national park for this, but the arrangements are not yet finalised, and we'll give you more details once we have them. Some details about the auditions. Students from any year can audition for any of the parts. There are three main singing roles, two male, one female. There are five speaking-only characters. These are minor parts, but they are central to the plot. We need 10 dancers, both male and female. In addition, we need a chorus of about 20 people. As you can see, this is a large production. If you would like to try out for any of these roles, you can come along to a meeting next week, and auditions will be on the 28th of October in the main hall. Details of the meeting and times of the auditions will be placed on the Humanities Notice Board. Individual and group messages will be sent via email. We're also urgently looking for people to join the orchestra. Many of its members left last year, and we'd like to make up the numbers again. We're especially looking for people who play wind instruments. If you'd like to make yourself known to Mrs. Sherborne at the end of this meeting, she'll give you more details. For those of you interested in working behind the scenes, please do let Miss Stewart know. We are particularly keen to know now if we have any painters amongst you who would like to work on the backdrops. This is because work on the scenery will start in January, and we were rather short of people last year. She's also keen to know if you'd like to help with the costumes, as work on these starts early next year as well. And if you have any odds and ends of material at home that she could have, which could be used for making costumes, please let her know.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Good afternoon, everyone. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Joe Major, Head of Drama, and I'd like to welcome you to this information session on the school musical. This year, we'll be performing A Tale of One City. This American musical was first performed in 1957 and has been popular worldwide ever since. It tells the story of two rival groups of teenagers living in the same New York neighborhood and is loosely based on themes found in Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. It has a very large cast of performers, and we'll be looking for a wide range of talents. Now, these talents fall into three main groups. Firstly, there are the singers for the main parts and the chorus. There are also speaking-only parts, and there are parts for dancers. These are the people who will be on stage. The second group is made up of the musicians, so people who would like to be in the orchestra. But that's not all. The third group, which plays an incredibly important part in the success of any production, is the backstage crew. We need at least 40 people to help out here, and we're looking for people to build the scenery, make the costumes, and do the sound, as well as promote the production. Whilst I will be the director of this year's production, other members of the teaching staff will be responsible for specific areas of the musical. Mr. Johns will be working with students wishing to be on stage. Mrs. Sherborne will be looking after the music, and Miss Stewart will be in charge of everything behind the scenes. They will be here at the front of the room once this presentation is over. Please sign up with a relevant teacher if you would like to be involved in this production. So, here is a brief timeline for the musical. It will be performed over 3 days in March. The first performance will be on Thursday, the 15th of March. This will be an evening performance. We'll do it all again on Friday, but on Saturday, the 17th of March, we'll be putting on a matinee performance as well as one in the evening. This is a new departure for us but we wanted you to experience what life is really like in the theatre. We'll be holding auditions next month, and rehearsals will start in November. We've also decided to hold a school musical weekend in late February, so that we can have an opportunity to relax and get to know one another more. We're planning to go to the National Park for this, but the arrangements are not yet finalised, and we'll give you more details once we have them. Some details about the auditions. Students from any year can audition for any of the parts. There are three main singing roles, two male, one female. There are five speaking-only characters. These are minor parts, but they are central to the plot. We need 10 dancers, both male and female. In addition, we need a chorus of about 20 people. As you can see, this is a large production. If you would like to try out for any of these roles, you can come along to a meeting next week, and auditions will be on the 28th of October in the main hall. Details of the meeting and times of the auditions will be placed on the Humanities Notice Board. Individual and group messages will be sent via email. We're also urgently looking for people to join the orchestra. Many of its members left last year, and we'd like to make up the numbers again. We're especially looking for people who play wind instruments. If you'd like to make yourself known to Mrs. Sherborne at the end of this meeting, she'll give you more details. For those of you interested in working behind the scenes, please do let Miss Stewart know. We are particularly keen to know now if we have any painters amongst you who would like to work on the backdrops. This is because work on the scenery will start in January, and we were rather short of people last year. She's also keen to know if you'd like to help with the costumes, as work on these starts early next year as well. And if you have any odds and ends of material at home that she could have, which could be used for making costumes, please let her know.
That's the end of part one. Now turn to part two. Part two. In this part, you will hear an interview with an explorer. Listen and answer the questions. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. 1 mark will be awarded for each answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition. I'm Sarah Westgate. In the studio with me today is explorer Mark Bloomfield. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks.
You have set up an organisation that is a sort of matchmaking service for outdoor types and scientists called Adventurers and Scientists for Conservation. Could you tell us more about it?
Our primary purpose is to bring together the outdoor and scientific communities. The first group does what it loves with an added sense of purpose, and the latter gets data that would otherwise be time-consuming and expensive to access. I would say, therefore, that the result is mutually beneficial. We connect these adventurers with conservation scientists in need of more data, whether it be from remote places of the world or from well-known parks such as Yellowstone National Park in the USA.
What do the adventurers get out of it?
Adventurers are often looking for ways in which they can do more. So this is a service for them as well. They can participate in something more meaningful than just the climb or the hike.
What inspired you to set up the organisation?
In 2004, I hiked the Appalachian Trail in the United States. There was one moment when I had fallen and was pretty miserable, so I picked up a rock and chucked it at a tree in frustration. It took a big chunk out of it. This was a really low point for me. Most importantly, it made me feel as if I was out there doing nothing that benefited the world or anyone else. So whilst I was recovering from my fall, I vowed that I would make a difference by contributing more to conservation.
Tell us about some of the projects that your organisation has set up.
We paired up an ecologist who studies ice worms at a university in Alaska with a ski instructor who was leading a group through the north of that state. She was able to provide the ecologist with some great information that he wouldn't otherwise have had the time or resources to get. Another one is a millipede project, which involved one of our adventurers collecting millipedes during an expedition to the Arctic on behalf of Kansas State University. As a result of this collaboration, scientists have identified a new type of millipede.
Prior to that, what other things were you involved in?
Well, in 2008, a friend and I became the first people to trek the length of the Andes Mountains south of the equator. The journey lasted nearly 2 years and spanned 7,800 miles. We followed the spine of the largest mountain chain in the world, and we created a new route. We visited many villages in the Andes. It is incredibly important for me to share the lessons I learned from the indigenous people, who have been using sustainable methods for centuries, and as a result live harmoniously with the land.
This year, you are organising a field workshop for young people on the American Prairie Reserve. What do you think will surprise students when they get there?
What I love about the American Prairie Reserve is that at first glance, you look out over a landscape that appears to be totally flat and uniform. But start walking, and you'll find that there are hidden gems everywhere. Water has carved out intricate patterns in the soft dirt and sand. Canyons dip down into the ground. Dinosaur bones are there just waiting to be uncovered. Prairie dogs are hiding in the grass. Every time you set out, you come across something that will surprise you.
When you were a teenager, what were you most passionate about?
I've always loved travelling. When I was 15 and 16, I was able to go to South Africa and Australia, which was transformative. At around the same age, I also went on a 3-week backpacking and sea kayaking expedition in British Columbia. All this gave me insights into nature that I had never had before. I felt immediately at home in the mountains, and it changed my life completely.
What advice would you give to young people who want to contribute to conservation?
I think it's important to think big, and to make sure that fearing the unknown doesn't keep you from taking a chance on something you feel passionate about. If you can conquer that and get past all the reasons why you shouldn't do something, you may just have a huge effect on the world.
What gets you up every morning?
I spend almost all my waking hours involved in conservation matters. Whether it's finding the best approach to a conservation issue like microplastics, or organising a team of people from diverse professional backgrounds to come together and track wolverines in Mongolia. I love how every day brings new challenges and the opportunity to figure out complex puzzles. Not only do I get to have an effect on the environment, I also get to empower other people to do the same. And as this organisation, Adventurers and Scientists for Conservation, grows and more connections are made, our impact grows exponentially.
How do you plan to expand the organisation?
We want to change the way everybody spends their time outside. So we're already running a citizen science project to train the public in how to participate in our conservation activities.
Is there something you never leave home without when going on an expedition?
There's nothing in my pack that I can't live without. I can be creative enough to find a solution if I've forgotten something, but without a journal, I'd be lost. If for some reason I don't have a way to record what I've uncovered in the field, then I can't share my findings with others or educate them in how we need to change to make the world a better place. Without this record, I feel that it is nothing more than a selfish experience.
Thanks for coming into the studio today, Mark. On next week's podcast, I'll be talking to...
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition. I'm Sarah Westgate. In the studio with me today is explorer Mark Bloomfield. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks.
You have set up an organisation that is a sort of matchmaking service for outdoor types and scientists called Adventurers and Scientists for Conservation. Could you tell us more about it?
Our primary purpose is to bring together the outdoor and scientific communities. The first group does what it loves with an added sense of purpose, and the latter gets data that would otherwise be time-consuming and expensive to access. I would say, therefore, that the result is mutually beneficial. We connect these adventurers with conservation scientists in need of more data, whether it be from remote places of the world or from well-known parks such as Yellowstone National Park in the USA.
What do the adventurers get out of it?
Adventurers are often looking for ways in which they can do more. So this is a service for them as well. They can participate in something more meaningful than just the climb or the hike.
What inspired you to set up the organisation?
In 2004, I hiked the Appalachian Trail in the United States. There was one moment when I had fallen and was pretty miserable, so I picked up a rock and chucked it at a tree in frustration. It took a big chunk out of it. This was a really low point for me. Most importantly, it made me feel as if I was out there doing nothing that benefited the world or anyone else. So whilst I was recovering from my fall, I vowed that I would make a difference by contributing more to conservation.
Tell us about some of the projects that your organisation has set up.
We paired up an ecologist who studies ice worms at a university in Alaska with a ski instructor who was leading a group through the north of that state. She was able to provide the ecologist with some great information that he wouldn't otherwise have had the time or resources to get. Another one is a millipede project, which involved one of our adventurers collecting millipedes during an expedition to the Arctic on behalf of Kansas State University. As a result of this collaboration, scientists have identified a new type of millipede.
Prior to that, what other things were you involved in?
Well, in 2008, a friend and I became the first people to trek the length of the Andes Mountains south of the equator. The journey lasted nearly 2 years and spanned 7,800 miles. We followed the spine of the largest mountain chain in the world, and we created a new route. We visited many villages in the Andes. It is incredibly important for me to share the lessons I learned from the indigenous people, who have been using sustainable methods for centuries, and as a result live harmoniously with the land.
This year, you are organising a field workshop for young people on the American Prairie Reserve. What do you think will surprise students when they get there?
What I love about the American Prairie Reserve is that at first glance, you look out over a landscape that appears to be totally flat and uniform. But start walking, and you'll find that there are hidden gems everywhere. Water has carved out intricate patterns in the soft dirt and sand. Canyons dip down into the ground. Dinosaur bones are there just waiting to be uncovered. Prairie dogs are hiding in the grass. Every time you set out, you come across something that will surprise you.
When you were a teenager, what were you most passionate about?
I've always loved travelling. When I was 15 and 16, I was able to go to South Africa and Australia, which was transformative. At around the same age, I also went on a 3-week backpacking and sea kayaking expedition in British Columbia. All this gave me insights into nature that I had never had before. I felt immediately at home in the mountains, and it changed my life completely.
What advice would you give to young people who want to contribute to conservation?
I think it's important to think big and to make sure that fearing the unknown doesn't keep you from taking a chance on something you feel passionate about. If you can conquer that and get past all the reasons why you shouldn't do something, you may just have a huge effect on the world.
What gets you up every morning?
I spend almost all my waking hours involved in conservation matters. Whether it's finding the best approach to a conservation issue like microplastics, or organising a team of people from diverse professional backgrounds to come together and track wolverines in Mongolia. I love how every day brings new challenges and the opportunity to figure out complex puzzles. Not only do I get to have an effect on the environment, I also get to empower other people to do the same. And as this organisation, Adventurers and Scientists for Conservation, grows and more connections are made, our impact grows exponentially.
How do you plan to expand the organisation?
We want to change the way everybody spends their time outside. So we're already running a citizens' science project to train the public in how to participate in our conservation activities.
Is there something you never leave home without when going on an expedition?
There's nothing in my pack that I can't live without. I can be creative enough to find a solution if I've forgotten something. But without a journal, I'd be lost. If for some reason I don't have a way to record what I've uncovered in the field, then I can't share my findings with others or educate them in how we need to change to make the world a better place. Without this record, I feel that it is nothing more than a selfish experience.
Thanks for coming into the studio today, Mark. On next week's podcast, I'll be talking to... That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. Part three. In this part, you will hear an extract from a science podcast about robots. Listen and complete the sentences. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each completed sentence. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions. Our topic today is animals that have inspired the design of robots. One such creature is the octopus, whose characteristics researchers have used to create new technologies. Octopuses have special cells that allow them to change the colour and pattern of their skin, and in this way they can hide from predators. Based on this characteristic, American scientists have created a four-limbed, colour-changing robot, which has a separate layer of tiny channels through which liquid dyes can be pumped in and out. The colours can be combined to help the robot blend into its surroundings. But the scientists are more interested in making the robot highly visible so that it could help locate people in search and rescue situations, for example. The current limitation of this robot is that when it operates underwater, it needs air to be supplied from the surface. The scientists are now focusing on creating an independent source of compressed air so that it will be able to function autonomously Octopuses also have suckers underneath each arm, which help them to hold on tightly to objects such as rocks or to catch food. A different team of American scientists has studied this feature to create suction cups. These devices could help robots grab objects, particularly in environments such as disaster areas, where it is too dangerous for humans to enter. The team has tested 4 fingertip-sized suction cups, and their results showed that they are strong enough to lift a bottle of water off the seabed. Work on perfecting these suction cups is ongoing. Fish have been another source of inspiration for a new type of robot. Silicone has been used to create soft-bodied fish robots, which twist and swim through water like real fish. One advantage of soft robots is that when they are working alongside humans, it is a lot less painful when they bump into someone. This is different from traditional robots, which are often made of hard materials and are programmed to avoid making contact with anything and so breaking themselves. Soft robots have more freedom of movement and are able to change direction quickly. It is planned to use robot fish to check for pollution levels in the sea, and also to use them to learn more about fish behaviour. This would require them to remain in the water for long periods. The only obstacle to this at the moment is the battery, which needs to be recharged every 8 hours. Jellyfish have inspired many robot designs, but the strangest looking so far is one by Chinese designers. They are working on an idea of using floating structures to address the worldwide problem of pollution. These machines, which bear a strong resemblance to giant jellyfish, would use hydrogen gas to float about 200 metres in the sky and purify the air by filtering out damaging pollutants caused by fossil fuels. These machines could also be transported to other locations within a city or to other cities in need of fresh air. The Sidewinder rattlesnake is unusual in its ability to climb sandy slopes without sliding back down to the bottom. This snake's ability to move up sand dunes could inspire new technologies for robots that carry out inspections of hazardous wastes and even explore ancient pyramids. Snake-like robots are interesting to scientists for several reasons. First, their lack of legs, wheels, or tracks means that they don't often get stuck in ruts or held up by bumps in their path. They could also be used to access areas that other robots can't get to, or to explore places that aren't safe for humans. The work done on studying the Sidewinder's behaviour is already being put to use in the design of several new robots. The biggest challenge when trying to create robots with legs is getting the balance right. A 4-legged animal tends to be a lot higher off the ground and is therefore more likely to fall over. Swiss scientists have created Cheetah Cub, which is currently the fastest 4-legged robot under 30 kilos in the world. Despite Cheetah Cub lacking a head, you can still tell what animal it is modelled on, particularly in the design of the legs, which make it very fast and stable. It is also extremely light and compact and can be easily assembled from inexpensive materials. It is hoped this concept could be used in exploration. Next week, we take a look at domestic robots.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Our topic today is animals that have inspired the design of robots. One such creature is the octopus, whose characteristics researchers have used to create new technologies. Octopuses have special cells that allow them to change the colour and pattern of their skin, and in this way they can hide from predators. Based on this characteristic, American scientists have created a four-limbed, colour-changing robot which has a separate layer of tiny channels through which liquid dyes can be pumped in and out. The colours can be combined to help the robot blend into its surroundings. But the scientists are more interested in making the robot highly visible so that it could help locate people in search and rescue situations, for example. The current limitation of this robot is that when it operates underwater, it needs air to be supplied from the surface. The scientists are now focusing on creating an independent source of compressed air so that it will be able to function autonomously. Octopuses also have suckers underneath each arm, which help them to hold on tightly to objects such as rocks or to catch food. A different team of American scientists has studied this feature to create suction cups. These devices could help robots grab objects, particularly in environments such as disaster areas, where it is too dangerous for humans to enter. The team has tested four fingertip-sized suction cups, and their results showed that they are strong enough to lift a bottle of water off the seabed. Work on perfecting these suction cups is ongoing. Fish have been another source of inspiration for a new type of robot. Silicone has been used to create soft-bodied fish robots, which twist and swim through water like real fish. One advantage of soft robots is that when they are working alongside humans, it is a lot less painful when they bump into someone. This is different from traditional robots, which are often made of hard materials and are programmed to avoid making contact with anything and so breaking themselves. Soft robots have more freedom of movement and are able to change direction quickly. It is planned to use robot fish to check for pollution levels in the sea and also to use them to learn more about fish behaviour. This would require them to remain in the water for long periods. The only obstacle to this at the moment is the battery, which needs to be recharged every 8 hours. Jellyfish have inspired many robot designs, but the strangest looking so far is one by Chinese designers. They are working on an idea of using floating structures to address the worldwide problem of pollution. These machines, which bear a strong resemblance to giant jellyfish, would use hydrogen gas to float about 200 metres in the sky and purify the air by filtering out damaging pollutants caused by fossil fuels. These machines could also be transported to other locations within a city or to other cities in need of fresh air. The Sidewinder rattlesnake is unusual in its ability to climb sandy slopes without sliding back down to the bottom. This snake's ability to move up sand dunes could inspire new technologies for robots that carry out inspections of hazardous wastes and even explore ancient pyramids. Snake-like robots are interesting to scientists for several reasons. First, their lack of legs, wheels, or tracks means that they don't often get stuck in ruts or held up by bumps in their path. They could also be used to access areas that other robots can't get to, or to explore places that aren't safe for humans. The work done on studying the Sidewinder's behaviour is already being put to use in the design of several new robots. The biggest challenge when trying to create robots with legs is getting the balance right. A four-legged animal tends to be a lot higher off the ground and is therefore more likely to fall over. Swiss scientists have created Cheetah Cub, which is currently the fastest four-legged robot under 30 kilos in the world. Despite Cheetah Cub lacking a head, you can still tell what animal it is modelled on, particularly in the design of the legs, which make it very fast and stable. It is also extremely light and compact and can be easily assembled from inexpensive materials. It is hoped this concept could be used in exploration. Next week, we take a look at domestic robots.
That's the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklets to be collected. Thank you and good luck.